This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
From robotic surgery to digital patient engagement through mobile healthcare apps, the explosion of new technologies has forever changed the science of the life sciences field. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the DIA Global Forum. Today, my guest is Dr. Bill Byram, Vice President, Product Strategy and Innovation for CRF Health. Dr. Byram also serves as Vice Director of the CPATH ePro Consortium, is a member of the DIA Study Endpoints community, and was chair or panelist for several sessions at DIA's 2018 Global Annual Meeting in Boston. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Byram, and welcome.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thank you, Alberto.
To get us started, can you just briefly describe the products and services offered by CRF Health so we have some context?
CRF Health provide patient-facing technologies and services for clinical trials. Our main area, probably the area we're most known for, is we're a leading provider of eCOA services. And our eCOA solution, that's electronic clinical outcome assessment, has been used in over 800 trials across more than 70 countries. We provide solutions for, you know, remote capture of patient-reported outcome measures, as well as site-based capture of those data using standard instruments, validated instruments such as quality of life measures. But as well as eCOA, we have an electronic informed consent solution that enables us to manage that process of informed consent electronically using multimedia, but also managing the complexity of that document management process for consent forms and reconsenting, etc. And then alongside that, we have the capabilities around connected device solutions. So alongside our eCOA solution, we're able to connect via Bluetooth, multiple sensors and wearable devices such as glucose meters, continuous glucose meters, spirometers, and so on. And as part of that capability, we have a subsidiary company, Entra Health, that's a manufacturer and distributor of two leading blood glucose meters that are extensively used in clinical research. In a nutshell, that's our service offering. But I think alongside the technology, we have a skilled set of staff who are skilled in the scientific and regulatory aspects of eCOA and e-consent. And we're able to provide that expertise alongside the operational and the technical capabilities that we offer.
So understanding what your organization does, who do you do specifically as Vice President for Product Strategy and Innovation?
I head Product Strategy at CRF Health. So I'm responsible for the ongoing enhancement and development of our existing products, but also looking for new opportunities and new technologies that we might develop as part of our product suite. And I guess associated with that, and you talked a little bit at the start about the DIA study endpoint community, you know, part of that is scientific development work, and I work along with others at CRF Health in a number of cross-industry work streams and initiatives. So the DIA study endpoints, for example, I'm leading a work stream on the use of wearable devices to collect clinical outcomes data in clinical trials. So I guess those two pieces really, the product management piece and also some of the scientific development work as well.
So clearly you're an expert in the field. As an expert, you were certainly very busy at our annual meeting in Boston back in June. So let's talk about the sessions where you participated. The first one was titled The Future of Endpoints. So what is that future?
It was a great meeting, I have to say, and there were lots of good sessions. But this session was about looking at new and novel ways to measure new clinical endpoints. We had three speakers or three sessions as part of that. Alexandro Zamora from PainQX talked about the work that they've been doing using EEG signals to develop new objective measures for pain intensity. And by using those, they've able to kind of map the activity in different regions of the brain to come up with indexes for pain intensity, and to have an objective measure of pain in addition to the patient's self-report, you know, could be quite an interesting advancement. And then Christian Gossens from Roche presented some of the innovative work they've been doing using the sensors within smartphones to deliver performance tests that can be done by patients at home. So we showed some really promising data showing the association between these remote-based tests to in-clinic tests, and also showed some good data that underlined how having that more frequent assessment and more frequent measurement really did enhance the understanding of treatment effects that they could get for some of the programs they were looking at. The final presentation was one that I gave, and it was about the use of motion-based gaming platforms and developing new endpoints using those platforms. So movement-based endpoints.
Gaming
so,
platforms, like it, video games.
Yeah, exactly, like the Microsoft Xbox. And using those same camera technology that is used for users to interact with games can be used to track the three-dimensional coordinates of your body position and the joints of your body. And by using that information, you can measure aspects of movement. So you could look at range of motion, for example, or reaching volume, or you could do a simple walking test and measure aspects of walking and gait. You can also use them for facial recognition, and you can track landmarks on the face to look at expression, for example. So if you're doing research in autism, that might be a useful component. So I looked at some of the work we've been doing in that area using the Microsoft Kinect, so the Xbox platform.
You've covered quite a bit of ground here in the area of endpoints. Let's look at how regulators look at all of this, because the data coming out of these wearable devices and video game platforms, et cetera, need to be, quote, valid, unquote. So how do regulators look at the validity of the endpoints that come out of these various platforms?
I think they look at them in the same way they look at any clinical endpoint. You know, at the moment, we're not far enough along to be able to claim that these would be endpoints that could support labeling claims, or at least in many cases, these are exploratory endpoints at this time point. But, you know, the kinds of things that we need to be able to demonstrate if we're using these solutions for clinical endpoints are the validity of the platform itself. So how accurate and reliable is it in measuring what we're intending to measure? And we'd need to be able to provide evidence to support that. And then for the endpoint we're deriving, we'd need to be able to understand its clinical interpretation. So we'd need to understand what meaningful change is in that endpoint, for example. And we'd need to demonstrate that the endpoint is sensitive enough to be able to detect the sort of changes that we're looking for. So there's more work to do. And I think a lot of the work we presented in this session was the starting point of a program of work to get these new measures into a point where they can be used as possible endpoints in clinical trials.
So are you saying that these endpoints have not yet been used in clinical trials, or they have been, but they've not been submitted to regulators for marketing approval? Where do we stand? Have any of them been used in regulator-sanctioned clinical trials at this point?
Well, certainly, the work that I've been presenting on the mobile gaming platforms is very exploratory. But in terms of the other things, I certainly know for the work that Roche have been doing, they've published a lot of validation work around the endpoints that they're delivering. And I know they have a program of work to further develop and validate those. So I can't speak for them in terms of where they're at in that, but certainly that's the direction they're taking that work.
You chaired another session, which was titled Bring Your Own Device ePro, Hold the Relish or No Holds Barred. Can you explain what Hold the Relish meant? And beyond that, what is appetizing about this topic and what's cooking for the future?
Yeah, I think that was just a cheeky title, really, but Hold the Relish or No Holds Barred. We were just trying to make a play in terms of, are we ready to do this Bring Your Own Device, or do we still have some limitations and some concerns? And so this session was all about reviewing the evidence around bring your own device and whether it was we're kind of ready to do this in phase 2 and 3 trials.
For patients to use their own device, whatever wearable device they have and they use normally, and use that in a clinical study? Is that what that means?
Actually, this was around electronic patient reported outcomes. So it was around using their own smartphone or mobile device to collect, you know, ePro data. It may sound somewhat straightforward and almost trivial that you think, well, this should be fine. But actually, you know, when we think about some of the validated questionnaires and instruments that are being used in clinical trials, they were developed on paper initially, and the measurement properties of those instruments were established through a lot of research, a lot of validation work. And so when you transpose those into a different format, so you take them from an A4 or a letter-sized piece of paper and you put them onto a small smartphone screen and you split them up into one question per screen, and you perhaps have to change some of the wording a little bit because, you know, you're on the questionnaire you say, please tick the box, and on the smartphone you'd have to say, please select or tap or some different language. Do all of these minor changes actually affect the way that the measurement properties of that validated instrument? When we do ePro using a provision device, in other words, when we give patients a standard smartphone to use in a clinical trial and everybody has the same smartphone, it's very easy to run a quick test just to show that the way they're responding on paper versus on the smartphone would be conserved. You know, those measurement properties would be the same. But when you're using bring your own device, you don't know what devices people are going to be using, and you don't know what the range of screen sizes is going to be. And you don't know whether that formatting change will affect the way that they respond. And so we presented a lot of the evidence, a sort of growing body of evidence to support the fact that actually, you know, when you follow good design practice, like the Critical Path Institute's EPRO Consortium guidelines, when you follow that, there's great evidence to show that when you migrate from paper to a smartphone, these measurement properties of these instruments are well conserved. But we also showed results from the first measurement equivalent study looking at BYOD against paper and a provision device. And this is the kind of the industry's first equivalent study, specifically looking at that. And in that study, we asked 150 patients to bring their own smartphones to clinic and to answer a questionnaire, but also to do it on paper and on a device we provided. And we did the statistics behind that and showed that the correlation or the association between the measurements was very high. Much, you know, as high as you would want it to be. And so great evidence to show that actually, you know, the size of the smartphone, the size of the screen, it really doesn't affect the measurement equivalence of these instruments if you're following design good practice. So some really good, compelling evidence to hopefully take us forward a little bit in our acceptance of this as an approach, because, you know, there are some benefits of using a patient's own device. I mean, not just in terms of potentially saving costs, but actually it should be more convenient for the patient. You know, they don't have to carry and maintain two devices, and it may lead to better compliance, better quality data, less missing data, etc. If they're able to use their own.
Patient comfort because they're using a device with which they are already familiar instead Absolutely. Of having to learn how to use another device which should use a different platform than the one they're used to, for instance.
That's a very good point. And actually, you know, one of the interesting things that came out of the BYOD study was when we looked at different age cohorts, we found that amongst the elderly patients, which were 65 plus in age group, there was a much higher proportion of tablets being used as opposed to smartphones. And so people are self-selecting devices that are usable to them. And that's a really nice feature of bring your own device.
So I guess the session allowed for an acceptance of the, you know, BYOD, bring your own device, and did not see significant limitations to that approach, while allowing some situations where the sponsor would provide the device to be used by all patients participating in the trial. Is that a fair conclusion from the session?
Partly, yes. Aside from the measurement properties piece, you know, there are other concerns and considerations around the use of BYOD. And some of that is really around, you know, avoiding missing data. And an example would be a patient may not have a suitable device for use in a trial. So what do you do then? Or the patient may have the ability, of course, on the BYOD to delete the app at any point, or they may run out of data plan allowance and therefore not be able to transmit the data. And so how do you deal with those other issues that you don't have when you're provisioning a device? And so we talked a little bit around that as well. And I think a lot of those issues are mitigatable through the solution design. So, you know, the fact that if you don't have connectivity because you've run out of data for that month, well, the data should be stored locally until you do have a connectivity to send the data. You should be able to monitor the compliance of every patient on an ongoing basis. So if you see that the compliance has dropped off, you can proactively reach out to them and figure out what's going on. Have they deleted the app? Have they changed their device? Do they need a provisioned device to be sent to them? One of the conclusions was we're not in a situation where we want to exclude patients from trials because they don't have a suitable device. So we must be able to provide a number of provision devices to each site so that if a patient shows up and they don't have a suitable device, we wouldn't be excluding them for participating for that reason.
Finally, you also appeared as a panelist in another session titled Potential Applications and Meaningful Outcomes for Mobile Accelerometry in Clinical Trials. So tell us, what were some of the most meaningful outcomes of that session?
This was a really interesting session, and it was a kind of a very new type of session for me. I'd not seen this kind of session before at DIA. It was pretty much an agile learning session. We had a catwalk where we could walk out and do things in the audience, and we had a lot of devices being demonstrated and the results being shown interactively on screen. It was a very interesting session. Martin Daumer from Munich University, he started off by talking about a simple clinic performance test, like a 5-meter walk test. And we had a volunteer from the audience to come up and do this test. And we had other volunteers to come up and try to make measurements around that test. And we used that as an illustration to talk about some of the benefits of instrumenting tests using an accelerometer, but also the limitations of a functional clinic test versus the measurement of free living activity in a home setting. And one of the things we looked at in particular is an emerging clinical endpoint called real world walking speed. And what's interesting about walking speed is it kind of encompasses a number of important components. So energy, movement control, physical activity level, your cardiovascular capacity, your strength. Lots of those things influence how fast you walk. And we've seen in the literature that real world walking speed correlates very well with survival in the over 65s. And so we looked at some of the properties of that endpoint. You know, another one of the really nice properties is that when you're walking purposefully, you tend to walk always at the same speed. And so when you're measuring real world walking speed, you don't have to have somebody wear an accelerometer for 24 hours in the day. They can wear it for a period of time and you can get a good estimate of that measure. Now, if you were collecting a different outcome measure, like the total number of steps that you take per day, you'd have to have somebody wearing the device for the whole period of their waking day. And sometimes that wear compliance is a limitation. And so that's a nice feature of this endpoint. And so we talked a little bit about some of the validation work that's ongoing at the moment in terms of validating that as a clinical endpoint. But we also talked about some of the other endpoints we might want to measure using accelerometers as well. Yeah, it was a very interactive and a very interesting session. It was great to be part of.
Must have been fun for the audience as well to be able to participate actively in the session as you described.
I think it was, and it was well attended, and which I think underlines, you know, the interest that there is in the use of wearables. There were a number of sessions on wearables at the conference, and they were all well attended as far as I could see. So I think that, you know, that just shows we as an industry have got a growing interest in how we can leverage these devices, because I think they are going to start to tell us things that that are valuable in terms of understanding treatment effects and health status in patients.
They certainly have the potential to provide substantial real-world data and, more importantly, real-world evidence, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think sometimes, you know, that real-world picture is far more important to the patient. So if we think about something like a 6-minute walking test that they might do in clinic, that's of interest. And I'm sure, yeah, it certainly does correlate with some aspects of how active the patient can be at home. But, you know, what's important to the patient, if I'm a COPD patient, what's important to me is, can I walk my grandchild to school in the morning? And, and that's the sort of thing that is captured using an activity monitor, I believe. You know, I think we get a good picture of how active they can be and they can elect to be in that home setting.
We've talked about a lot of different types of innovation as they relate to clinical trials and endpoints and mobility, et cetera. So in closing, what is your favorite definition of innovation? How do you know that something is innovative when you see it?
The dictionary definition of inventive, which I kind of like, is having the ability to create or design a new thing or to think originally. Thinking about the sessions I was involved in, I think one of the most exciting things at the moment is seeing how we're leveraging existing technologies in new ways to do new and original things that they weren't intended to do so. So we think about an accelerometer again. Accelerometers were put into smartphones to detect when the device is being rotated. And that enables the software to flip the screen from portrait to landscape as you rotate the phone. But now, of course, it's the same chip, it's the same sensor that's being used in a Fitbit or an activity monitor. And so it's now possible to develop an app that reads from that same sensor and provides information about health and about fitness and about activity. And one of the American physicists, Freeman Dyson, one of the quotes that he made, which I really love, is that the year 2000 was essentially the point at which it became cheaper to collect information than to understand it. And I really believe that. I think with the Internet of Things, you know, the sensors that are around us, that our devices contain, you know, we're collecting lots of information. The challenge in terms of innovation is how we now leverage this information in new ways and original ways to provide meaningful insights. And those insights will help us understand patients' health status and the effects of the new treatments that we're testing.
This has been a fascinating conversation, Dr. Byram. Thank you very much for your insight and participation today.
Oh, thank you, Alberto. It's been a pleasure.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.